I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. On the urgent matter of AI, artificial intelligence, genuine intelligence is here somewhere, in a four-way conversation with the MIT physicist Max Tegmark. His new book is Life 3.0, Being Human in the Age of AI. First, let's do the numbers on life and this crooked timber of our humanity. Life 1.0 was man and nature born. Life 2.0 was us plus our man-made culture, language, music, nations, some near miraculous tools over 100,000 years or more. Life 3.0 is what is coming. Digital information machines that run deeper, faster than we can dream, much less compete with. Can you see the moment coming when those machines will have made baby machines, when we are more them than us, when the machines can be said to have taken over? Is it here? On Boston Common this week, we asked people to free associate on AI.
Do I think robots should have their own mind? No, I don't. Because a machine can't know right from wrong. It doesn't have compassion.
AI, what do you feel about that, John?
What don't you feel about it? You feel about it.
I don't feel good about it.
Neither do I.
Because you need a brain to think, not a computer to think.
You've got to bring
a real human, life-breathing thinking.
Puts a lot of people out of jobs, but you know, it is what it is.
It's very cool. The possibility that somebody would think for me when I don't want to think.
It could definitely be used by governments and intelligence services, which I don't think is a good thing.
Love it. Love my Alexa. Alexa, turn on the lights. Alexa, what packages have been delivered today? Alexa, turn on Sonos to play music. Like, literally, she's my best friend.
Max Tegmark is the Swedish-born physics professor at MIT who soars through the cosmos and eons of time, past and future, in his book, Life 3.0. You're up for the chase, Max, toward a human-level, multitasking AGI, artificial general intelligence device. But you write midway in the book, we have no idea what will happen if humanity succeeds in building such a thing. Take us out into your world. Where are we going? Where are you going?
Well, what's very clear is that during the 13.8 billion years that have passed so far in our universe, most of it was just really boring and dead, and then gradually life appeared and very clueless about its environment. And gradually, though, we've started to understand more and more about nature through science, and then we've used that science to build technology that lets us control nature and even start to figure out what we are and start replacing our muscles with machines. And now we're sort of on the verge of beginning to replace our brains by machines. And the question is, where do we want to go with all this? Do we want to just blindly bumble into what's going to be the biggest transformation ever for life on Earth without any planning? Or do we want to take a good hard think about what kind of future we want to create with this technology?
You write that our human extinction is imminent in the cosmic context of tens of billions of years. How in the world can we plan that far out? We're still steering by Plato, but, 3,000 years ago. How do we imagine steering this place?
We're not talking billions of years here. We're talking, according to many leading AI researchers, about maybe decades until we have machines that can do everything that we can do. So well within the lifetime we have, and anyone who's planning for retirement on that time scale or is concerned about climate change has to pay serious attention to this. I'm optimistic that we do have the potential to create a really awesome future with technology if we win the race between the growing power of the technology and the growing wisdom with which we manage our technology. But that's going to really require a change of strategy, because historically we've always stayed ahead in the wisdom race by just learning from mistakes. We invented fire, messed up a bunch of times, invented the fire extinguisher. We invented the car, screwed up a bunch of times, invented the seatbelt, the airbag, and the traffic light. But with more powerful technology, which is inevitably coming, like nuclear weapons, synthetic biology, and superhuman intelligence. We don't want to learn from mistakes. That's a dreadful strategy. It's much better to plan ahead, work really hard to get things right the first time, because that's the only time we'll have.
So you mean we have to do it? And if we didn't do anything, you know, with mind machines, where would we be?
We would be, I think, in the situation that we really wish we would have paid more attention. You know, wisdom is important. You would never just walk into a kindergarten and say, hey, kids, take this little box of hand grenades and have fun playing with them, right? We don't want to do that with humanity either and just give ourselves a bunch of technology we're not prepared and don't understand how to manage.
Max, I read your book with great interest, but recurring questions like how did we come to think of wisdom, or how do we get comfortable with the thought that these answers will be delivered in numbers?
Well, to me, the most interesting question isn't to speculate about whether we're going to be comfortable that everything is going to be great or not, but rather to just ask, well, like, what concrete steps can we take now that are going to increase the odds of a good outcome? And for starters, we have some very, very basic questions, like how do we transform today's buggy and hackable computers into robust AI systems that we can really trust? How can we get machines to understand our goals, adopt them, and retain them as they get smarter? Things like this, which are tough enough questions that they might take us decades to answer. So we really need to research them now so we have the answer by the time we need them, you know, not the night before someone switches on a superintelligence.
Draw us a picture. You raise a question for readers toward the end of the book, sort of pick your own utopia. What's yours? What does it feel like?
Yeah, I had a lot of fun in the fifth chapter of the book exploring all these thought experiments, different kinds of societies you could have with very advanced AI. And I'm not really trying to tell the reader what they should prefer, and I'm actually quite torn myself. What I do feel very strongly about, though, is that we all need to think about this, and we can't just leave this discussion to AI and tech nerds like me, because it affects
everyone. Throw out some notions. You talk about, you know, we could all be living in a zoo under somebody's care. We could be living in authoritarian regimes. We could be living in diversified regimes. What's the dream?
Well, sure, when you mention the zoo and stuff, we have to remember that intelligence, of course, can give power. And the reason that we have more power on this planet than tigers isn't because we have bigger muscles or sharper claws. It's because we're smarter. So if we go and create machines that are much smarter than us in all ways, it would be naive to just take for granted that they're always just going to be our little obedient slaves and that we're going to stay in control. If that's what you want, we have to plan very carefully for it. But other people think we shouldn't even try to do that, but we should instead just make sure that these machines adopt our goals. You know, you and I were in the presence of beings that were more intelligent than us once upon a time when we were kids, you know, mommy and daddy. And that was fine because they had our best interests in mind. Many people hope that we can make machines that really understand our goals and want to help us achieve them.
I'm wondering about the worldview that's on offer here and the view of human nature. Who are we at our best? What are we striving for in terms of justice, in terms of curiosity, in terms of knowledge, in terms of love? What are you valuing here when you program your future?
Here I can only speak for myself personally, the sort of things I value, of course, to creating a family an environment where people can really have relationships that mean a lot to them, where people can pursue curiosity and so on and so forth. But I would prefer to not create some sort of monoculture in the future where everybody just has to be the same way. I think artificial intelligence can be an amplifier that can amplify everybody's dreams for how they want things to be, as long as they don't harm others. But, you know, when you amplify our ability to do great things, you can also amplify our ability to cause harm. And we'll probably talk a lot during the hour here about how society itself, we have to reshape it to be able to to cope with this.
Two great old wise men came to mind as I read your book. One, Enrico Fermi, the physicist who said during, I think this was in the 40s in the bomb program, but he, over lunch, he would say, there are billions of places where life could have been born. We haven't heard from it yet. And the reason is that life has an inescapable tendency to get complicated, get technological, and then destroy itself. And they're gone, in other words. How do we know that this kind of technologized future isn't a warning that the game's coming to an end, that we're on a bad path?
It could be, although I think the explanation to the Fermi paradox is probably a different one. We have discovered that planets are a dime a dozen. We have over a billion very Earth-like ones, even in our own galaxy, that are much older than our planet. And I suspect that actually we are the only life that's gotten to the point of inventing telescopes even in the part of the space that we can see, because we were probably very, very lucky in the very early stages of evolution for reasons we don't quite understand. This is my guess. It's kind of a minority view. And that means, if I'm right about this, that means that we have an enormous opportunity, if we manage to not go extinct, to help life flourish not just on this planet, but throughout much of our cosmos.
The other question from an old-time thinker, Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher, 18th century, who gave us the line, out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made. What makes us humans think that we can bootstrap ourselves into something better?
I don't think there is any guarantee that we can, but I think there's absolutely no better way to make sure that we fail than by just convincing yourself that it's impossible and not trying our very best.
We're reading Max Tegmark's book, Life 3.0, Being Human in the Age of Artificial Intelligence, this hour. Coming up, what can you tell about AI in the future from AI that's already in use today? This is Open Source. Eric Brynjolfsson joins the roundtable with Max Tegmark on being human in the age of artificial intelligence, including having a job to do and a paycheck in an AI world. Eric, I know you, I should say, as MIT's wary eye on the digital workplace and on the march of technology in general. You're known for mindful optimism, but Max quotes in his book rather serious cautions about what AI is doing in the workplace. You say it's polarizing, it's a main stimulus of inequality in the world. Let's hear you on AI.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and this is a really important issue. And as Max described in the first part, this, I think, is the grand challenge for our society, our economy going forward. And part of that is the economic challenge. I don't think we've handled it very well over the past 10 or 20 years, even 30 years, because as you said, although we've created unprecedented amount of wealth, the GDP is at a record high, GDP per person, more millionaires and billionaires than ever before, most people aren't participating in that growth. The median income at the 50th percentile is basically flat since 1997. Now, I want to be clear, there's a lot of forces at work there. It's not just the way we've been using technology. And the technology that was at play over the past couple of decades is different from the one going forward. But one of my concerns, as Max suggested, is that we're getting ever more powerful technologies. These technologies have more power to automate work, more power to create wealth and abundance, more power to cure disease. And depending on how we use them, we could have the best decade ever or the worst decade
ever. That's a guess, but you have some very interesting hard data. I'd never thought about it before, about how AI, the complexification of knowledge, is contributing to inequality, continually raising levels of training, for example, to do the work of the world. Also reserving the rewards for owners, not workers. And also fascinating to me, J.K. Rowling is richer than the Queen of England, as Shakespeare never ended up, precisely because of digital technology. She sells to the world. It's changing our culture, but it's also, you know, pulling us apart in lots of ways.
It can be. And I'm with Max. This is not automatic. It depends on how we use it. But it's certainly true that digital technologies, let's just take the case of J.K. Rowling, she's able to reach millions, actually billions of people in a way that no previous authors were able to. And that's largely because of digital technologies, movies, other kinds of rights. And it's brought her a great deal of wealth. It's brought all of us a lot of happiness. Those of us who read, Harry Potter and saw the movies, it was a lot of fun. But depending on how you manage your society, you can have vastly growing inequality.
How do you fight it? How do you stop it? How do you say we're going to have the goods, but we're not going to tear the country apart?
There's no single silver bullet, but there's a collection of things that we can do and that we've done in the past. It starts with education. America led the world in education in the 1800s and 1900s, and that's a big reason we not only became wealthy, but became more equal than other societies. You can put in tax policies, social security, safety nets. You can encourage antitrust to make sure that companies don't get too powerful. You can encourage entrepreneurship, not because everybody needs to become an entrepreneur, but because entrepreneurs are the people in our society who primarily invent new goods, services, and jobs that replace, that take up the slack for the old jobs that get automated. So there's a collection of things we can do and we should be doing. Expand the earned income tax credit, I think, is in front of Congress right now. That's a way of putting more money into the hands of people who are working and not getting as much from the market system.
Hold it there, Eric. Kathy O'Neill, I want a couple further introductions. Kathy O'Neill, who's been our neighbor in Somerville, is a mathematician, data scientist, and the author of a provocative book called Weapons of Math Destruction, a cutting critique of AI as it is. Then Yardane Katz in our studio works and writes at the intersection of AI and biology at the Harvard Medical School. Kathy,
yes,
on the phone from New York, please jump in. AI in front of our eyes. Do we see it?
Well, here's the thing. I feel like when people actually are asked to define AI, they kind of give you a cop-out definition typically, and they talk about things that they're studying and that might happen in the future. And what I want us to focus on are the algorithms, the predictive analytics that might not be that sophisticated, but they're happening now and they are currently destroying people's lives.
Well, how so?
In all sorts of ways. We have, for example, the scheduling algorithms that we learned about that Starbucks uses that makes people close one night and open the next night and have irregular schedules. We have algorithms that judges use to sentence criminal defendants that we have good reason to think are essentially racist. We have teacher evaluation systems that are statistically very flawed, but yet teachers get fired because of their scores. So we have like a lot of challenges right now with the way we've replaced human processes with algorithms that we're not dealing with. So I feel like we don't have to worry about a future dystopia because we're living in a dystopia right now.
The question from Max seems to me is AI reinforcing our prejudices, our blind spots, our historical discrimination, or is it getting us out of it? Well, she's saying it's the problem. Or it reinforces our own human problem.
I feel that we have a lot of challenges now, and I agree with what you just raised as concern here. That doesn't mean that the issues we have to deal with decades from now, if we get superintelligence, should be ignored either. I think we should tackle them both. For the near-term ones, I'm very happy that you're raising these absolutely crucial issues where people have often a blind faith in algorithms because they don't realize that what they're doing is actually not something we should be trusting. And I think actually one of the key parts of AI safety research, actually this is something we're actually working on in my lab at MIT even, we call it intelligible intelligence. How do you take some opaque AI system that does stuff like probation recommendations or whatnot and transform it into something which we humans can actually understand. You know, if a human judge were to sentence me to 20 years in jail and I asked why, and all she could say was, I was trained on 5 terabytes of data and this is my decision, which is final. Wouldn't that be a little bit unsatisfactory?
Kathy?
Yes, it is unsatisfactory, but I would argue that if we build the scaffolding for the algorithms that we're currently using, that we have good reason to think are flawed and are propagating racism and all sorts of other kinds of inequality, if we build that scaffolding for these simple predictive algorithms, then we will have sort of that in place when we have more complicated algorithms.
Oh,
yes. And that's absolutely required technology, but it doesn't make it, it doesn't require us to talk about something that's going to happen in 20 years.
Eric,
we can just
Eric, jump
right
in.
Now.
Yeah, so Kathy, you're absolutely right that there are some very flawed algorithms out there. I would nuance what you're saying and saying at the times you say the algorithm's deciding this, it's us humans who are deciding these things. And we have to remember that the main reason that the algorithms are flawed is that they're trained on human data. Judges who were racist or sexist, or managers who wanted to have a schedule that wasn't good, and actually, I'm more hopeful in that I think it's in many ways easier to fix the algorithm, to understand it, to correct it, than it is to get thousands of judges and thousands of managers to change their views and things. And algorithms can actually be more fair and more unbiased if they're written correctly. So there's an opportunity there. We haven't fully seized that opportunity, but I think at the end, an algorithmic decision can be fairer than humans who also are flawed.
Kathy, what I'm hearing is exactly the crooked timber problem. How do you get out of your own history of distortions into something straight? Yardane Katz, it's your turn here. I from at the intersection of biology and AI, what are the premises of where we're going here? What should they be?
Well, so I agree with Kathy about the fuzziness of the label AI, and I think it's worth asking, why are we having this AI conversation now? And I think that in the last couple of years, AI as a label has been rebranded in a way that's very self-serving for companies like Facebook and Google, and it's been rebranded around a very narrow notion of intelligence as finding patterns in big data. So that kind of notion of intelligence is very useful if you're trying to sell ads to people. But we should keep the politics in mind and when we talk about AI.
Right. Would you give us a short history? I remember Marvin Minsky, artificial intelligence at MIT. The question was whether a machine could write a Mozart piano piece. And then it seemed to go out of fashion. Why is it back? Instead of what?
So I think in the within the history of AI, the term has always been plastic and always been prone to rebranding by corporate forces. So the connectionist philosophy within AI, from which the new fad of deep learning came out of, was not fashionable in the 70s and then became very fashionable in the late 80s with very similar arguments to what we're hearing now. We have a lot of computing power and a lot of data, and out of this big data, really magic can emerge. So that kind of view is very appealing if you're a company like Facebook or Google. I want to add one other thing. I think it says something. It comes with a kind of ideology about human nature. And I think that it's bringing back this Silicon Valley vision is really bringing back a kind of behaviorist view of psychology. So the view famously associated with the Harvard psychologist B.F. Skinner that behavior is all that matters and that behavior can be shaped endlessly by reinforcement from the environment. So it's a kind of denial of the rich mental worlds that we have. And if you look at companies like Google's DeepMind, they're selling this vision that through reinforcement learning, which is this framework that essentially committed to this behaviorist idea, we can do anything intelligent that people do. So you have to think about what that says about human intelligence.
Max, come back to the great goals that you're after, and they're listed in a kind of manual of how many, 25 points. I didn't see equality in the society of the future, and I wondered about it. There are all sorts of rational goals in it, but what are the core things that we're striving for?
Oh, equality was, in fact, one of the 23 Asilomar principles that there was very strong agreement around, that this is sort of, we want to create a society where ultimately everybody gets better off. I just want to add to the comments.
There's a difference between getting better off and seeing fellow creatures as equal. Equal before the law, equal before the Almighty, who knows what.
Certainly. I just want to comment on what was just said here. Also, I completely agree that, of course, we need to tackle these short-term challenges. Otherwise, we're never going to succeed with the longer-term ones, with human-level AI. Even if we can't even make our computers unhackable, then anything advanced we ever build in the future can be turned against us, right? But at the same time, I think it's also very dangerous to be in denial of the possibility that machines will someday be able to do absolutely everything we do. I think many people tend to dismiss this as science fiction, because we think of intelligence as something mysterious that can only exist in biological organisms like humans. But as a physicist, from my perspective, intelligence is simply a kind of information processing performed by quarks and electrons and moving around in certain ways. And I'm made of exactly the same kind of quarks as a computer. And there's no law of nature saying that supporting this kind of carbon chauvinism, you know, that you have to be made of carbon atoms to be smart.
Yardane Katz. Yes,
I don't think it's about carbon chauvinism. I think that what you've just said actually points to the fact that AI researchers have traditionally ignored the social and historical context in which human reasoning takes place. So, for instance, when we look at a picture in the United States of police brutality against African Americans, we can instantly read off the emotions, the relationships between the actors, the power dynamics. And we read it in a particular historical context in the United States, and different people read it very differently. And those kinds of issues, power dynamics, gender, race, have always been profoundly uninteresting to AI researchers because they think of this universal notion of intelligence that transcends the human condition. And I think that that assumption is problematic.
Let me say that. I just want to agree there.
This is a very important point that we should not confuse intelligence with goodness in any way. You know, intelligence to me is simply how good something is at accomplishing its goals. You can be very good at accomplishing the goal of helping people, or you can be very good at accomplishing the goals of harming people, like Hitler was, right? And the intelligence itself will only do good things if we, in addition, put in these other things to make sure that
I think this is actually a key point. I mean, that you have a certain set of goals that you think are very important, and I share most of those. But artificial intelligence is a tool, and people are using it right now to do lots of things that aren't on your list, but they're still very useful. They're using it to improve voice recognition. eBay's translation system is much better than it used to be. We can recognize objects. We can use it to start building self-driving cars. So there's an array of very small, specific tasks that are being accomplished at human or even superhuman levels, and that's what the excitement about. It's not a fad. It's not a fashionable thing. It's something that is paying off in dollar terms to a lot of companies right now. They're not touting it because they have, I don't think, a political agenda. I think they're touting it because it's working for them.
Kathy, maybe it's your turn. What I'm hearing is that Yardane's point that AI professes to have perspective, have self-consciousness, to make it us aware of the flaws that keep getting us into trouble.
But in fact, that's what AI professes to do. I don't think that's what AI professes.
Is it not aiming to escape the crooked timber again? Forgive me, but
there's a long-term agenda to achieve those things. The kinds of AI that are available now are nowhere close to doing any of those things.
We're talking about sentencing guidelines, insurance guidelines that persist in sexism, racism, other kinds of injustice.
Reduce sexism that make fairer judgments. Yes, there are guidelines that help make all those kinds of decisions. And if we do them right, they do a better job than what we had before.
Did we need machines to do it? And is that what they actually do, Kathy?
Yeah.
So first of all, I want to agree that we can do better. And that's absolutely, I think, the future is that we figure out how to make these algorithms do better. And by which I mean become more just and more fair by our definition. But I want to just poke a little bit at this concept of we, because I'm just going to echo what a couple of the other guests said, which is that when we talk about adding morals to AI, that makes no sense to me. For me, it really is a question of how you train the algorithm, because at the end of the day, it's an algorithm, on a definition of success. And all the algorithms I talk about, and they're trained to the definition of success that the builders of those algorithms have, which is typically efficiency or profit. It has nothing to do with fairness. And if we want fairness, it's not going to be a simple situation like you hear so many AI researchers talk about, like Go or chess, where there's a simple winner and everybody knows the rules of the game and it's clear when success has occurred. It's going to be much more about a negotiation between the different stakeholders. So you have the criminal defendant who has civil rights that they want to protect. You have the judge. You have the public that wants to be protected from violent crimes. And it's always going to be the question is always going to be who gets to make the final decision about what the definition of success and, for that matter, the penalty for failure is for that algorithm. And so when I hear about morality, I'm like, no, it's not morality. It's a negotiation, and it's like every other negotiation in our society, and I don't want it to be owned by tech.
A political process, in other words, Jardin?
Right. So I think that when we focus on the algorithm, we actually deflect critiques of the greater systems that are at play. So when we talk about unbiased robo-judges, for example, for sentencing, we are under the illusion that our criminal justice system is not somehow racist or that it doesn't intersect with other forces in society. So by looking at an algorithm, we are actually kind of diluting that critique.
Is there a short answer, Max, before the break? I mean, again, it's a matter of escaping ourselves.
I would just remind everybody, humans are far from perfect. And so the benchmark isn't, and unfortunately can't be, perfection. It's can we do better than we're doing now?
We're talking about artificial and some genuine intelligence. And Max Tegmark's book, Life 3.0. Coming up, Facebook as a corporate model of what deep data is all about and how it actually works in this world today. This is Open Source. And what do the gods of our business culture have to say about artificial intelligence? Here are two of them. At sword points, if you can believe sound bites, first the Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, and then the futurist entrepreneur Elon Musk of SpaceX and the Tesla Auto Works.
With AI especially, I'm really optimistic, and I think that people who are naysayers and kind of try to drum up these doomsday scenarios are... I don't understand it. I think it's really negative, and in some ways, I actually think it's pretty irresponsible. Because you know, in the next 5 to 10 years, AI is going to deliver so many improvements in the quality of our lives.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence. If I were to guess at what our biggest existential threat is, it's probably that. I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon. You know all those stories where there's the guy with the pentagram and the holy water, and he's like, yeah, you sure you can control the demon? Didn't work out.
That was Elon Musk, who runs his own private NASA at SpaceX, and before him, Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook. I'd like everybody to take Facebook as an example, a community-building tool or something that turns out to be very, very good at surveillance of a commercial variety, especially, and an appropriator, we now begin to see, I didn't know what they meant, but taking our creative energy or whatnot and making incredible amounts of money on it. We are not the customers or the users. We are the producers, and they own it. Jump in, Jardin. What can we learn from Facebook, including the sort of migration of its reputation, its purposes, its wealth?
Well, I think that the Facebook case shows that people are beginning to realize that when you have centralized wealth intersecting with centralized data, bad things can come about, and that it's not what Facebook is doing is not under democratic control in any way, and that this is a force to be reckoned with. And I think that with respect to AI and this talk about superintelligence, that gives the impression that actually Facebook can do a lot more with its data than it can, and I think it creates a lot of panic in the public. So, for instance, there's an Israeli company called Faceception that claims to have built an AI that can look at a picture of a face and tell whether that person is likely to be a terrorist, and they're of course selling it to governments. Mm. So Facebook is, well, a collection of faces, and I think that we should really think very carefully when we talk about superintelligence, and are we feeding basically, are we laying the groundwork for people to believe these kinds of nonsensical AI promises?
Max Tegmark, what does Facebook tell you, including the corporate the corporate power in it. And what sort of a, you know, what sort of a little product of the AI wonder world is this?
Well, first of all, of course, it shows why this technology is so unstoppable, because there's so much money to be made off of it. But I have to take issue with Mark Zuckerberg. With all due respect to him, you know, the comment we heard him make here about how we shouldn't worry about AI and it's kind of irresponsible alarmism to do so, I think is really just short-sighted. If you look at NASA, which you just mentioned, you know, when NASA put Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins up to the moon and brought them back safely, they spent a lot of time thinking through everything that could possibly go wrong when you put three dudes on top of a 100-yard tall rocket full of highly flammable stuff. Was that alarmism? No, that was safety engineering. That's exactly why none of those things actually went wrong during the Apollo 11 mission. And that's exactly what I think we should do as we develop ever more powerful AI as well. We should think through everything that could go wrong, not because we're alarmist, but because that's the way we're going to make sure that things go right.
I was fascinated through the book. I kept thinking, why isn't NASA doing this? Why isn't the government doing it? And not just our government. This is a global, this is a complete, every 7 billion of us has a stake in this question, and nobody has a vote. Why is it a corporate bonanza, not a the greatest human mission ever undertaken?
Well, our American government is generally not investing as much in certainly not increasing its funding for research the way a lot of other governments are in Asia now. So it's not limited to AI. But I think that a very valuable thing that all governments can do is to not just fund the power of technology, computer science research, but also make sure they fund the AI safety research to so we can figure out how to make our machines not buggy and hackable, so they can figure out how machines can understand human goals and adopt them. All of these tough questions we talked about earlier, to get the answers, we really need a serious crash program to tackle them, you know. And I think politicians are kind of asleep at the wheel. Look at the last presidential debates rerun. You know, they don't even talk about AI.
Why not, Eric? And are we just going to leave it to the corporate world? I mean, because all kinds, I mean, unimaginable profits are.
Well, that's why I'm so glad you're doing the show, actually. I'm so glad the people listening to this. I think we have to change the conversation. This is a huge, important issue. Some people, Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk, have both seized it. They both may have huge AI investments, and they've been successful in the past. It'd be great if the U.S. government got more into it. China has made it a priority. Putin famously said that he who controls AI will control the world, just in this sort of way of speaking. And I think in our system, the government won't do it until and unless the people demand it, because more or less the Congress and president listen to people at some level. And if we want to have more of an AI program, an AI safety program, but also basic R&D. I think that the companies are great at taking some of the technologies and applying them to monetize it and make billions of dollars. That's why they're so excited about it. But there's some fundamental research that they're not going to be doing and that we should be doing. It has the potential to cure a lot of diseases, to help disabled people, to make all of us a lot wealthier than we were otherwise, to reduce the amount of work that we have to do, yes, and give us more leisure time. It has the potential to do all that in a way that makes us better off, but it won't happen automatically.
Kathy, can
I jump in and give my version? I mean, so first of all, there's plenty of laws that I think are being broken that are not being enforced because regulators just don't understand technology enough to be able to audit the algorithms to show they're illegal. Second of all, you know who else is asleep at the wheel? It's academia. And I'm glad that there's some professors as your guests, but there are just a handful, at last count, a handful of faculty tenure lines, like tenure track jobs in this entire country devoted to algorithmic accountability, but just like dozens and hundreds that are devoted to trying to get a job at one of these big corporations like Facebook and Google. The result of that is that when I went to a congressional subcommittee meeting on big data and analytics, the experts talking to Congress people about big data were all basically you know, they had vested interest, and they were, there was no critique, there was no worry about accountability or what could go wrong. So the Congress people are just people, and they are not technologists. We have to educate them. And when I say we, I mean people that have the ability to think quietly in a space that is not commercial. And I just don't feel like we have built that space yet.
Why not, Eric?
Well, I think we should. And that's another thing that I'm glad we're talking about in the show. And I was just reading, it was horrifying to read about the Supreme Court sort of being very math shy. And I wish that they were more willing to take into account technology and mathematics and embrace it to understand some of these problems. But the question I have for Kathy, who is a math whiz herself, is the alternative of not using these technologies to improve decision making, I think, is even worse. We have a lot of judges who are very biased, and there's been studies by, you know, Nobel Prize winners like Danny Kahneman that demonstrated that judges make systematic mistakes. And the last Nobel Prize was just given for those kinds of human biases as well. We have the potential to do better. A lot of biases are built into the algorithms, but I'm actually hopeful that we can improve on that dimension by using technology, and it ultimately can become more transparent and more accountable than it was when it's all done by, hey, I want to hire this guy because he's kind of like me.
I would completely agree with you, but we simply don't have the buy-in from the justice system to even know whether, in the presence of these algorithms, whether it's become less or more racist, because that's how, you know, how like data hoardy they are. So I'm just saying that, you know, I absolutely agree. We could make these better algorithms. We haven't bothered to do that yet. We're still acting on blind faith and plausible deniability.
Yodine Katz.
I want to just echo Kathy's very important point about vested interests. I think there's a kind of politically naive assumption that the AI entrepreneurs and leaders, the people who are actually standing to make a buck out of this stuff, will self-regulate. And so companies like Facebook and Google are funding the computer science conferences. They're funding PhD fellowships. They've hired many of the people in this statistical big data field, which has now been renamed AI. They've hired those people to head their labs, and they have panels at conferences that are comprised basically of only these people to talk about how they're going to do good with AI. And I think that's very problematic, and we need a different space to think about that. So I completely agree with Kathy.
The big thinker Yuval Harari writes in reviewing your book, Max, that when science becomes politics, scientific ignorance becomes a recipe for political disaster. That's a real warning, especially to those of us who are seduced by the voice of Alexa, sort of charmed by these little installments we get. I'm not sure why we should trust Silicon Valley or Wall Street or even MIT to be deciding these questions in a small concentration of masterminds.
You just articulated why I really wanted to write this book, because I feel this is a conversation that's so important.
Is it a pitch, though, or a warning, or a call to arms, a call to action?
It's an invitation for everybody to educate themselves so that they can join this conversation. I completely agree with what was said earlier here, that our politicians will only pay attention to this and do the right things if people, the people who vote for them, actually know about the issues and care about them. And I wrote the book to welcome people to actually learn enough about this so they can join the conversation and start to make their voices heard as well. I think we absolutely need that.
You worry very powerfully at the end of the book about an AI arms race, in effect. Why in the world, on a species concern, are we not hand in hand with Chinese scientists, for example?
We obviously should be, but economists, Eric Brynjolfsson and colleagues, have studied for many years how sometimes people get into these sort of prisoner's dilemma situations or tragedy of the commons situations where when everybody just follows their self-interest, they end up in a place which is worse for everybody. How do you overcome
that? There goes the
species. Yeah, how do you overcome that? Well, by incentivizing collaboration. How do you get collaboration? Well, one of the best ways is for people to all have a positive vision where they realize that if they work together and collaborate, they can create a society which is much more inspiring than anything we could dream about if we fight. It's only then that we can do it. And what I think is so pathetic today is, you know, I just came back from seeing with my wife the new Blade Runner movie. Huh. And every single movie pretty much you go see gives visions of the future these days, which are dystopian, right? Mm. Which is what we need is to actually try hard to articulate positive visions. If we succeed in doing that and getting really fired up about them, that's when we'll collaborate across borders, across disciplines, and really create a good future. If you have no idea what we want, we're not going to get it.
Be done by cheerleading. How do you?
But it can in part to be done by cheerleading. And I want to point to last week we had something called the Inclusive Innovation Challenge at MIT. We gave away $1 million to 16 companies that were using technology to create shared prosperity. And each of them were remarkable examples of how showing the way that you could use the technology to make masses of people better off. They didn't lead to more concentration of wealth or violations of privacy. And I think by pointing and recognizing people and organizations that are doing that, I think it's going to inspire more people to do that. Because certainly there's more than one way to use this technology. You can use it to violate privacy, to create more bias, have more concentration of wealth and power, or you can use it to have more shared prosperity and a more open society. Either of those is possible with the technology. There are choices, and some of those choices the government can help with, some of them entrepreneurs can help with, and if we do show the way, I think more people will choose the path that I think almost everybody would prefer.
Well, I wonder. I read this book with real concern that AI is a perfect model of the concentration of authority, of money, of benefits that we worry about across the board.
It's not technological determinism. There is more than one. The technology is a tool, and we now have more powerful tools than ever before, which actually means we have more choices than ever before. We have more ways of using that technology. If we are willing to wake up and use those choices. If people are asleep at the switch, as Kathy was saying earlier, then other people are going to seize those tools.
Kathy, can I ask, it's not a moment when you're just dying to hand a big issue for debate to Washington, but how would you productively make it a political issue? There are important...
I mean, it is a political issue, right? I mean, right now, Mark Zuckerberg might run for president. And if he does, he could legally manipulate the Facebook algorithm to show good news about him and to get rid of bad news, because there's no law against that. We just simply don't have control over this influence. It could be pure propaganda that he's spewing, and there's no law. We could make him feel bad about it. We could make him issue statements when he gets caught, but it's ultimately proprietary software that he can do whatever he wants with. So, I mean, it already is a political issue. The question is, do we have laws that can confront it? The closest I've heard of are antitrust laws. Unfortunately, the antitrust law in recent history has been focused on consumer prices. And this is not a question of consumerism. This is a question of being a citizen and being treated as a citizen and being allowed to be well-informed as a citizen and as a voter. We don't have the laws right now, and we don't have the sort of the will, the political will and understanding to confront this.
Make it an irresistible argument, Jardine, that everybody's got to get in on.
Right. So I think we should frankly put aside the AI question and think of the conditions that we now have, where we have globalized information processing systems that can surveil us. And that's a fact. And the question is, how do we exist in a world with these systems? Do we want them there? And how do you bring in democratic control into those global information processing systems? That's the political question. And I think a lot of the talk about superhuman intelligence creates confusion and distracts from these political questions.
Can you imagine putting it to a vote? Is there a question here that we could all apprehend, learn about, talk about, argue, and then vote on here, Max?
You want to vote here in the studio?
Well, sure. Sure.
Or in the country?
Well, no, I'm thinking of the country, the world.
Yeah, but to do this, of course, it's very important that we first learn and understand the issues well. And that's why we're so grateful that you are putting these sort of things on the air.
Thank you. No, but my vote would be stop the music, come back to the argument without numbers, talking about who we are, what is possible. Where is art in this? Where is creation? Where is existential fear? How do we get this into a robust public meeting? Eric, last chance.
Well, I think that's a good place to start. I would emphasize what Max said. It starts with learning about it. We shouldn't just vote blindly. We have to understand these technologies. But ultimately, what's going to determine is what our values are. And we have to understand what we want the technology to do. If we understand our values, we can make the technology do the right thing if we want
to. That's where we'll start the next hour. Thank you, Eric Brynjolfsson, Kathy O'Neill, Yardane Katz, and, of course, Max Tegmark. Thanks also to Yasha Bach. Our show is produced by Humans All, Karna Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, Susan Coyne, George Hicks, and Mary McGrath, our Chief of Intelligence. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.